This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 359 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me via Skype from just down the road in Sydney, Darren Purbrick. How are you?
I'm not too bad, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, good. So what have you been up to in the 6 weeks since we shot Jaden and Beck's wedding?
Apart from your barbecue?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Keeping busy. I've been retouching, and I've also had a couple of shoots on where I've been doing a conference, cocktail parties and that kind of stuff for one client, which I'm in the middle of processing at the moment.
So you're shooting their social engagements for them?
Yeah. Basically, this weekend has been I shot their cocktail party, which was their opening night. Then all day Monday, I was doing their conference. And while I was doing the conference, you may have seen on Facebook about me trashing a hotel room.
Oh, yes.
I achieved something that Led Zeppelin have managed to do many times.
Nice. But
I got to put it back as well.
Yeah, right.
Yes. While we were shooting the, I had the run sheet, and apart from taking shots of all the delegates that were talking, I had to do the directors' headshots, and it was a case of headshots, three quarters, full body, group shots, and of all the staff for their Sydney office and some of their regional managers and that kind of stuff.
So how many faces all up?
Oh, there's got to be about 25.
Right.
25 people. Together, and that was a mix of group shots and individuals. And I've got, I shot tethered for that one. I had a hotel room which was really small, and I just basically shoved everything up onto the wall, beds into the bathrooms and all that, put a white backdrop, put two lights up, put brollies, and I just kept it flat as, the light.
Right.
Some of the retouch is actually going to do that with their or their designer.
Can I just ask, why did you do it in a hotel room? Surely they had a conference room that would have given you a little more floor space.
The conference room, they hadn't allocated any space to as such to shoot this in the conference, because the area that they got the big, if it was held in the Hilton,
right,
and it was a big conference room on the third floor, and then the rest of it was open planned for trade stands.
Right.
So there was nowhere on that floor that where they were holding it that I could put up a backdrop and be safe.
Yeah, right.
With that kind of stuff. So what they'd done, they'd organized it, they hired up a bedroom, and I was always concerned, and I did express my concerns about this might not be too big.
Yeah.
And yeah, it played out to how I thought it would. And but I, in true professional style, you made sure you got the job done.
Yeah.
Because they said they didn't really wanted to get a bigger room. And I said, that's fine, because they were limited on their budget. I said, let's make do with what we got. And I anticipated this a long time, because they were kind enough to send me a picture of the room and a floor plan.
Oh, wow.
And so I'd already worked out my ideas of what I was going to do and contingency plans and stuff like that. So, yeah, so beds went up against the wall. The mattresses went up against the wall. The TV went behind me. The beds went in the bathroom. I put the backdrop up on stands. And, yeah, I just did some simple, like, copy lighting. But I did use a ratio a little bit when I just tried to bounce a lot of light off the walls.
Yep.
Because people with glasses and that kind of stuff. So
you don't just want direct light for that.
No, that's it. And the client was very impressed in what we did. And when everybody came in, they were walking into the studio, and the comments were coming thick and fast, which actually helped break the ice. So, yeah. And they were going, oh, it's great. It was a bit like the TARDIS and Doctor Who. You walk into this really small room, and all of a sudden it goes, oh, we got a photo studio.
Nice. Nice. So we should probably give people a little bit of background. What's your career path in 50 words or less?
50 words or less. My God, how long we started off as an apprentice scan operator working Crossfield drum scanners for a local newspaper.
So what does that mean?
A drum scanner is a color device. Basically, we used to mount film and transparencies and prints and all that onto a large drum. You used to set an XY point, which was a start and stop point of the size of image, or where the image is on the drum. And we used to enter white, enter black, and do color measurements and spin it. and it used to spin at high resolution, and a light source or a camera basically would track it from between the two points that you'd set. And the other side of the room, there'd be an output unit, a laser unit, outputting it into four color separations, cyan, magenta, yellow, black,
yep,
for the printing presses. And then they were outputted to the size that you wanted it. So if you got a 35 millimeter transparency, I could enlarge it to whatever size you wanted to.
Right.
There was limitations. And then we used to plan them up on foils and make litho plates that go on the presses. That's slightly changed with technology nowadays, where you tend to either shoot it digitally and then Photoshop takes over and you do the color correction through Photoshop and Capture One and Lightroom and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then you can enlarge it and that kind of stuff. And then InDesign puts it into the page.
Yep.
So there's no output of film until you actually output for the final four pieces of film that shows the colors and the tints. We were outputting films that and making foils for these plates that could be anything, where you have these litho plates that would take 8 or 9 different types of exposures at different times because of vignettes and colors and all that kind of stuff. So it was quite in depth.
Yeah, right.
So that was that. And then where did I go from there? That was a local newspaper back home in Telford, mm-hmm, in the UK. And then I went down to London, worked in a trade house, went up to Liverpool, worked in another trade house, got a job on the Daily Mail as a scan operator and colour operator, got taken on there. That was only a 6-month contract. That was, again, operating the Crossfield kit. And it was just the advent of where Apple Mac had started coming into the desktop publishing and
right,
the revolution of Photoshop, which yeah, we are right now. We're now looking at 1990.
Right.
Photoshop 1 was an amazing piece of kit.
I can imagine it would have been cutting edge for its day.
It was. And what we did with it was just simple stuff. And then the development, it was changing left, right, and center. And so I was probably one of the few guys in England. We were leading a revolution in one sense of what you could do digitally, because everything wanted to go digitally.
Yeah.
They didn't want to use the films. They wanted to try and streamline it. I worked on the first newspaper that went totally digital. So the photographer took the photograph, I scanned it in. The image was not actually handled by a person until it was bundled into the van at the other end on the print after it got printed, and it was put into the van to be delivered.
Yeah,
so
right,
it's all done by robots and all done digitally. So that was the Daily Mail. I was there for about 12, 13 years. I got offered a job over here. Well, I wanted to emigrate, so I put in my papers in London, worked in a trade house, and then came out here and worked for Fairfax for 10, 12 years.
Right. So. And along the way, you've picked up quite an in-depth understanding of colour management.
Oh, yes, you had to. I've also a photographer as well, professional commercial photographer.
Sure.
That's really been going since I've lived in Australia.
Right.
And because everything was film, and it was when Nikon brought out the D100, and I only bought the camera, so I thought, I'm having a kid, well, let's take family pictures like most people do.
Sure.
Before I know it, everybody's turning around, and I thought, well, if I can combine this with my Photoshop skills, I'm laughing. And that's right, what I did. So it's just taken off. But it does take time and traction to build up as a photographer and get known and established. So,
Which is
where I'm at now. It's starting to get more traction, and I'm getting busier and busier, which is good. But I'm also a lecturer as well at one of the local city colleges, teaching color management, Photoshop, commercial photography techniques, and that kind of stuff.
Wow,
it's full on. Oh, yes. You can't earn much just from photography nowadays. You've got to be, you have many strings to the bow. So I've kept it all imagery. And it's working okay. So touch wood so far. But sure, color management is a big part of my life. Big part.
Okay. So let's talk about that. What's the most commonly misunderstood part of color management?
Not calibrating the screen. They don't know why. What is the difference between sRGB and Adobe 98 and Profoto? And, how come I can take a photo and I shoot RAW, but I can't get the image straight away? From some clients, they think, what you see on screen is what you get. And mm-hmm, that's probably the biggest misconception. They'll see a picture, they go, oh, that's great. And then when they see it printed, they go, it's nothing like what I just saw. Why is my screen different? And this is the problem that a lot of people have got, especially clients.
Yep.
Very poorly educated because they don't understand that kind of stuff. They don't want to know that kind of stuff.
Do you know why I'm laughing?
Go on.
Because I get clients who listen to the commercials that I've mixed in a, you know, $200,000 studio build, who listen to that commercial on their iPhone and then critique the mix. So I completely relate to what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from.
So let's go back to you mentioned color spaces, sRGB, Adobe 98, Profoto, etc. What exactly does that mean?
Okay, you've got to think of color. Everything's to do with, I mean, my side of things is relating to taking an image that is a additive color space, an additive where red, green, and blue make white light.
Right.
And I'm converting it into subtractive, where I'm actually using the secondary primary colors of cyan, magenta, yellow, which then make black. And I'm trying to convert the visible image on the screen to a printed image, and you've got to change it. Color space
let's not race all the way to print yet.
color space is pretty much, if you can imagine it as some form of three-dimensional blob, so to speak. Not so much a sphere, but everybody seems to base. I tend to base everything on a sphere based.
It's a matrix that's not a cube.
Yeah. This was, if you go to the history, it's Albert Munsell was one of the key players with this. He actually stated that color is three-dimensional.
Right.
You have luminance, chroma, and what was the other one he said? Chroma and saturation. Yeah. So hue, saturation, and brightness. Think of it as a circle. This is how I try and teach my students. Think of it as a circle, and you've got the North Pole, South Pole, which is North Pole is your highlight, which is your white point, or a white bright point.
Yep.
Your shadow is South Pole. Then
you've got luminance vertically.
That's luminance, yeah.
Okay.
That's just pure black and white, brightness and darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have, if you imagine the Earth, you've got the core, you've got the sea level, which is the chroma, with the equator. You know, that is the chroma. That's pure color.
Okay.
Okay. Then if you work from the center core to sea level, you're playing around with the saturation and desaturation, and then you can go up to, say, the atmosphere, and you go oversaturate. So you play around with the strength of the color.
So at the core of the planet, we've got all grayscale.
Yeah.
And at the surface of the planet, we've got full saturation.
Yeah.
But then if we go further out from that, we then
oversaturate.
Right. Okay. Cool.
Then goes beyond. You know, there is a limit, which then you won't be able to reproduce. You may be able to see some stuff with the human eye, but most screens and printing, you will not be able to print oversaturated colors because you lose tonal definition. You also lose detail in pictures and that kind of stuff. So this is where you've got to color correct. By having a color space of sRGB, it brings it down even. It's a really small space, which all computer screens are based on.
So they're all based on sRGB?
Yeah, except two.
Right. Which two are they?
They are the iZone monitors and the NEC spectral views.
Right.
There's a couple of others, the LG and Samsung, have got pulled out something in the last couple of years. But since I've been working in the industry of print, it's always been an iZone monitor, and NEC have just, you know, for some time I've had a good screen that can hold 98 to 99% of the Adobe color space, which is bigger,
right,
which is everybody uses for printing.
Okay. So if I shoot RAW, does a RAW file have a color space?
Nope.
Right. So what happens when you open your RAW file in, say, Lightroom, and you're working on a monitor, like for me who doesn't have an ISO monitor, so my monitor is most likely sRGB.
Yep.
Does that mean Lightroom is using the sRGB color space, or do I have to tell it?
Okay, you don't tell it anything,
right?
And you can't. When you're dealing with a raw photograph and you pull it into Lightroom, Capture One, Camera Raw, Adobe Camera Raw, their presets are all Profoto, which is a very big color space that fits within the dynamics of what they've mapped to be the human eye. If you've ever seen the little logo on an ICC, what they call an ICC profile, which is like a little horseshoe with green and reds, and that horseshoe, that is represent, that little horseshoe represents the human eye.
Right.
If you're on a Mac, the best place to go and look at these color spaces will be in the color utilities panel. So if you open up the applications, go utilities, go color sync, open it up, and inside there you'll be able to actually click on different sizes or different profiles and color spaces, and you'll see the size and they change shape.
Right, but your monitor is still only going to show you a fixed range of colors and saturations. Right.
Yes, yeah. And the better the screen, like a Mac Retina, you're going to have a little bit more latitude on what you can actually see.
Yeah.
It is a little bit a hard one to try and, because you're not going to see the difference really within the Adobe space and the sRGB, because you're looking on an sRGB screen.
Yeah.
But this is where a Photoshop came into it, and they said, okay, we'll soft proof, which is where you can actually see the difference on different color spaces change by going into the settings. Soft proof really is developed for looking at the difference between, or trying to represent your screen to being a piece of paper.
Right.
Using paper, what they call paper profiles, which is a subtractive profile. You know, this is where it all goes completely into the outer spheres, and I goes, I've lost everybody. You try doing it to about 14, 15 different level students on a Monday night. It's interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what's the best approach for your average photographer? If your goal is to create an image to be viewed on the web, you know, because you want to output your image, you know, so you can send it to Instagram, Flickr, Facebook, wherever. What is the best profile to output in?
sRGB.
Right. Not Adobe RGB.
Not Adobe, no. You will see a slight difference. Your images will look, if they were Adobe space, they would be look a lot flatter, because there's a lot more color and dynamic range to the image, and the screen will have a very hard job of trying to represent that.
Right.
So what happens, it's like the Apple, you know, Apple and Windows or VHS and Beta. Earlier on in the year, back in the 90s, it was Windows. Gates came up with, and they said, all monitors need to have some form of color profile so everybody sees it exactly the same.
Right.
Within a range. So he developed sRGB, which is standard red, green, and blue. That's right. What it stands for. Or satanic, or, you know, or dare I say shit. You know, it's the lowest of the low.
Right.
But it's there for a job. And it's to make sure that everybody's screen, no matter where they are in the world, shows the color within a good range and can show most of the colors.
Right.
Okay. Adobe is a lot bigger, which came about in around about 98, when Photoshop started looking more into, well, from people, you know, what I was doing in on the Daily Mail and other operators and companies that were looking into it. They were trying to expand it and make Photoshop more controlling of color, because it was really developed for, you know, the printing and reproducing pictures. A lot to do with the printing industry. So, and Photoshop said, well, actually we can, or Adobe said, well, actually the color space can be a little bit bigger for printing. Even though a CMYK color profile, color space, that size ball is a lot smaller than the Adobe. It's what can be fitted into it and mapped.
Oh, really?
That's probably what the key is. Everything is mapped, and you know, to a size to try and make it fit.
Yep.
And the basics is, boy, it's all based on the human eye. And then within that, if you look at, you've got triangles, and Profoto is the very largest. Great for archiving. It'll hold, you know, far more colors than you will ever be able to print and reproduce. Adobe's the next one down, sRGB, then CMYK. But certain points of them colors, because it's three-dimensional, stick out. So that's, you know, of different sizes, because you've got to think about it not looking at flat on or 2D. You've got to think of it 3D.
Right.
Because that brightness, saturation, and color. So yeah, there's a lot to it. But if you're doing printing, Adobe 98. If you're doing web work, sRGB. If you're doing archiving, you know, you can either, whatever you want, I would say go with the biggest, keep it profile. Well, if you keep your RAWs, you're okay. Then I always export my TIFFs for Adobe 98, and then I do sRGB, you know, for different versions for clients.
Yep.
They don't know. they don't understand. So you're trying to do stuff to help them out and make me look good. And that's why people come back, because they don't have that much problem with the work that I supply. So, but yeah, it is a major thing. But there are certain key points you've got to have in place to make sure that your color stays consistent throughout your workflow.
Yeah, right.
Screen is probably the key point.
So I'm a little confused, because a minute ago you said if you're going to print, use Adobe RGB.
Yeah.
Is that referring to just your dot matrix printer at home, not a CMYK print?
No, CMYK is all to do with publication printing, you know, newspapers, magazines, right, books, posters, you know, commercial printing. When you're going down the avenue of then photographic labs, this is where it gets a little bit confusing, and you need to look at the instructions of the lab and the recommendations of the photo lab. Because some will say, we wanted sRGB file, a JPEG or a TIFF. Some will say, well, we want Adobe 98. It also depends on whether you're printing on an inkjet printer or the dichroic light, you know, where they burn like a Lambda printer. They will both be Adobe 98 color spaces that you would need to supply your images with, you know, or color space of that image to. sRGB, then you're pretty much going to say that's a little cheap machine printing, Harvey Norman, Office Works, and it's a general color space that you will get a reasonable result off it. They will be able to hold most colors, but I wouldn't, and personally, I wouldn't guarantee all the color and the quality that would come off, say, an Office Works printer, you know, lab, because it's just a question of upkeep and looking after it. They're probably not, they've probably got a general operator that does.
I was going to say, their operator probably wouldn't have the deepest understanding of all this stuff either.
No. If the image is important to you, go to a professional lab.
Right.
Simple as that. And talk to them. They are more than happy to sit down with you and say, well, what do you want? This is what you've got to supply, and if you've got no Scooby-Doo whatsoever about how to do it, they will probably be more than happy. So, well, if you give us an extra $5, we'll do the processing for you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But look on their websites. All good photographic labs will have details on what you need to supply. If you're unsure, speak to them.
Yeah,
they're always more than happy to talk to you. Yeah. They want the work, but they also want to guarantee that you're going to come back and get the work consistent.
Yeah, and like myself as an audio engineer, they probably have a certain level of pride in the work that comes out of their lab. And, you know, if they're having work supplied to them by someone who may not be completely up on all of the, you know, technical requirements, then they're probably happy to supply that information just so that what ends up leaving their lab is as good as it can possibly be.
Yeah,
I know what it's like when I have, you know, material supplied to me by external sources. You know, if they haven't got a clue, I'm, you know, the first one to say, hey, can you do this or do that to give me a better quality of product so I can at least turn out something that's half decent.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, it's again a pride, and that's why you pay the premium price at the lab. Yeah. You're paying for somebody's experience, you're paying for, you know, quality chemicals, and you're paying a little bit for a guarantee that what you give them, say, tomorrow, you would actually go a week later, 2 days later, 2 days later, a week later, a month later, a year later, 4 years later, you're going to get the same result off that same image.
Yeah. Now, I just want to sort of circle right back to where we started. You mentioned about monitor calibration.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't have $3,500-$4,000 to drop on an ISO monitor, the majority of computer monitors these days strike me as being reasonably good to look at. Now, I don't know whether you would hold that same view, because this is your bread and butter. How far out are most computer monitors in terms of, you know, their color representation to the viewer? Are they all, you know, are they over accentuated? Are they reasonably flat in their response? Or
it depends on the brand that you've got. Like I mean, my home setup. I've got an ISO monitor. I've got a 5K Retina Mac to work. Now my 5K Retina Mac, when I calibrated with the device, it looked great, but I can only hold so much, or it will only be able to represent and visually show me so much of, say, the Adobe color space.
Right.
Around about 70%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Big drop off.
Yeah, you know. Right.
But it'll hold 99% of the sRGB space because it's a lot smaller.
But hang on. Isn't it an sRGB monitor?
Yeah.
So why does it only hold 90% of the color space?
Because of the white. There's a lot goes into it. There's, you know, fade off, and it depends on where you've calibrated. You should calibrate to the center of the screen, and it's all mathematically worked out because you can go to different points around the screen and it'd be different. The age of the and the age of the monitor, the brand of the monitor, that has a big play with it, you know, the difference of how you see it. And once you've calibrated it, I mean, I have it with my students, they go, "Oh wow. You know, it's gone from being blue to being warm." And I don't like it. I want to go back to being cold and cool. I said, "Well, tell you what, leave your Mac on or leave your computer on, go and get a cup of tea, come back 5 minutes later and I will do something to it and then you can see." I do nothing to their screen.
Yeah.
I just tell them go and have a break.
Just give
and
their rest eyes the a rest.
Yeah. And come back and it goes normal. So and things like that. So yeah, it's quite interesting. The you know, everybody sees it and they suddenly realise, oh wow, that's the difference.
Yeah,
but yeah, having a good monitor, like say an ISO, yeah, you're gonna have it's the quality build, and they guarantee that it will show that much colour because it's a precise tool.
Yeah.
Whereas a Mac, even an LG monitor, some monitors you cannot calibrate.
Why is that?
Well, it's not the monitor that you calibrate. It's the video card in the computer that you calibrate and set up what they call a lookup table.
Right.
And it's like a filter, and it's like an on-off switch. And say, well, okay, do you want to use this filter or do you want to use that filter? And you just build up a library, and you just – you know, slotting it in and telling it, right, you're going to use this, and this is how I want my color to look, and it's all to do with computer geeky speak, which is even beyond me. I just know how to use the devices and know what happens. I don't know the computer code.
Right, so that brings me around to calibrating the monitor. Does that always require a piece of hardware like a Data Spider, or are there other ways to do it?
There are other ways to do it, but the other ways to do it, which I would say would be tend to be more of an analog way, where you go into, say, a Mac, because that's what I use, you go into colored displays and your preferences, and you can actually move sliders around to get it visually. So, you can move sliders around to get it how you want it to look. And you think that you've got it correct. And then if you use a device, it's more precise. The computer is actually telling some software, it's software driven and device. Basically, the way the monitor works or the calibration works is you fire up the software and you put the Spider or i1 or there are Color Monkey and you put it on the screen, and the software fires particular colors at this through the monitor to the device. The device reads the color. And then what happens, once it's gone through the routine, it then goes away. A few seconds later, it will work out the difference between what the monitor has actually shown and what the color should be in the software, works out the difference, and then calibrate. You know,
and applies the filter accordingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to do is you've got three types of settings. You know, the settings, the standard industry setting, is to do with white balance. It's all to do with making your screens white look white.
Yep.
So D65 Kelvin or 65,000 Kelvin is what everybody tends to go to, you know, as in your white point for the screen.
Right.
And that will get you across the board on anything.
Okay.
If you're going more precise with printing and all that, then you would look at making your white point D55, D50, and you're getting a lot bluer because you're trying to make it a lot flatter and you're trying to represent the paper and stuff like that. You don't want a screen that, like most Macs now, I hated it when Mac went to a glossy screen.
Oh, okay.
Because it's done for the general populace because it makes the picture look fantastic on the screen. It's nice, it's bright, it's got depth, it's glossy, you know, everything great. I'm trying to represent, you know, a piece of paper and I'm going, crap.
Yeah.
It's too glossy, too bright. I've got to, you know, desaturate the picture, hence the ISO monitors. And the ones that are specifically built for printing are all flat, lustered screens.
Yep.
So, yeah, but you need a device because it takes out the guesswork.
Yeah, right.
Even the cheapest Color Monkey at $120 is better than you relying on your eye because yep. your perception of color.
I was going to say, if you're trying to do it by eye, aren't you at the mercy of whatever light source you've got in the room?
Yep, are the whole factors there, the age of the monitor, the room that you're working in, the light source that's on, you know, things like that all play a big part on how you perceive color.
And
white balance at the end of the day is to make sure that the whites look white, there's no color cast, and they're neutral. But, you know, there's so many ways, you know, can you describe white? Well, there's loads of whites, but which one's the best? So that's why you use a device.
Yeah,
it's
right.
safer.
Wow. I'm sure we could disappear down this rabbit hole for hours.
Yeah. You want to come on one of my 12-week courses? That'll do you. That'll do
your brain. Shall we get on to some of the stories we've collected this week?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Okay, so the first one, I'm not going to click on this link because it's a YouTube video, but it will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check it out. This is a short 2-3 minute video on Peter Lindbergh shooting the 2017 Pirelli calendar.
Oh, dream job.
yeah, exactly. Now, what I thought was interesting was, historically, this calendar has always been about, you know, absolutely sexy girls, you know.
Well, not all of it, because I remember, as a kid, I remember the Pirelli calendars.
Right.
And so they've always, as you say, they've always asked for renowned photographers to do it.
Yep.
But I can't remember the photographer, but one of them went abstract. There was not one female in the shot.
What?
It was, this was going back sort of late 70s. I think it was late 70s.
Right.
And, yeah, but if you notice that subtly somewhere in the picture there is a tire tread.
Right.
Because it's Pirelli cars. Yeah, right. Pirelli tires. But, yeah, but there is one photographer that never shot any female.
Wow.
Never shot girls. I'm pretty sure of it, yeah.
Yeah, right. So that was the thing that struck me about this was, certainly my interpretation or my understanding of the Pirelli calendar was that it was always, you know, really gorgeous women in it. Not to say that these aren't, but he specifically said, let's go and just find the best actresses in the world across all age groups. You know, so he's, you know, got like Helen Mirren, who must be in her late 60s, early 70s now. And
I think she's about mid 70s.
Yeah.
Still looks
and just a whole range of different actresses, you know, like different ethnic backgrounds, different age groups. And I thought it was interesting, and particularly off the back of last week's episode, talking to Craig Wetchen about his approach to shooting portraits and, you know, interacting with people. And, you know, the more I talk to photographers, the more I keep hearing the same thing about, you know, get to know your subject.
Yeah, get to know your subject. And, yeah, I learned that a long time ago. One photographer told me he used to go to the extent of doing a background check on them and finding out what music they liked. Yeah, and so when they walked in, there was a broken ice already because
he's
the
got
discussion
their music going.
That's it, and he's got them a bit more relaxed and got them more on side.
Nice.
I thought, that's clever.
Yeah, totally. Have a look. It's a great little video. Like I said, it's only 2 or 3 minutes, and I just thought it was worthy of sharing. And then I came across a thing on creativelive.com, 16 top photographers share the best advice they've ever received. And there's some great tips here. Some of them were really simple. Some of them were quite deep. I liked the second one from Brooke Shaden. If I don't go out and get what I want, it likely won't be handed to me.
That's true. Yeah.
Nothing
ever given to you.
Exactly.
You've got to go and find it.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's just a whole bunch of really interesting quotes here. I like this from John Gringo. However big your camera bag is, you'll fill it.
you wanted to see mine. I mean, I've got a large Billingham bag, and I mean, I'm always carrying like 200mm, 24-70. I've got two bodies, two flashes, and all that kind of. I've got trigger.
I mean, I know gorgeous. What it was like trying to lift your camera bag out of your bloody car 6 weeks ago.
Felt now like you know why I went and bought a Land Rover.
Felt like I'd done a weights workout.
Yeah, you try carrying that on your shoulder all the time. That is,
I can imagine.
Yes,
but anyway. Yeah. And another great one that I liked here from Johnny Davenport, from my dad, keep the focus. Little did I know how literal those words would be to my life's calling. Very nice. Anyway,
that reminds me of a guy, who's his David Hobby.
Oh, yeah.
And he does one, and it's called The Compass Point.
Right.
And it's on the same lines, but he's really, you know, and whatever you're going to do on a job, always have focus on a compass point of where you're going to go.
Right.
Even whether it's in job or where you want to travel to, as in a career and that kind of stuff, which was quite interesting. So, yeah, David Hobby is another good one.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Rakesh sent me an email just today with a link to a TED Talk, a guy called Stephen Wilkes, and he's developed, you know, so often on this podcast, we talk about, you know, people who develop a niche with their photography. You know, it might be a certain way they shoot or a certain way they post-process. What this guy's done is he's created this whole project, which he calls Day to Night, and I haven't watched the entire video, Rakesh, because I only just got the link just before we started recording. I managed to watch the first couple of minutes of it. And essentially what he's doing is going and finding an iconic location, setting up his camera on a tripod, and he will stay there, in his words, anything from 15 to 30 hours.
Oh my God.
And shoot, and shoot somewhere in the vicinity of 1,500 images. And then he layers the whole lot and selectively chooses different things that happened at all points of the day and night in this one scene. And he creates these images that some parts are nighttime, some parts are daytime, some parts are, you know, golden hour, blue hour, whatever.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the screen now and he's got a snippet of it, and it looks amazing. You know,
it looks fantastic. Like I said, I saw about the first 2 or 3 minutes of it, and I will definitely be going back to check out the rest. I think it was about 12 minutes, was it, Darren?
Let's see. Yeah, it's 12.36, if you want to be precise.
So there you go. So not a massive investment of time to watch, and it certainly looked very interesting. So thank you, Rakesh.
That's interesting. It's, you know, why don't you just do time lapse and just blend it together? You know, it's far easier. Let Photoshop do the work.
And I guess this is the whole thing. You know, it's coming up with that creative idea. This is the sort of guy that Glyn would say, "Oh, we put him on the people we don't like list." You know? But it's coming up with that niche idea and having a, you know, an idea in mind of how you're going to process it and come up with a finished image. And it's just something that no one else is doing, or, you know, certainly not making any noise about.
I remember, I mean, I've noticed, you know, because I grew up with film, you know, from shooting with my dad right up to now where I've, you know, I teach my kids, you know, we do shoot film, and I still do, and I shoot digital. The difference now is everything's so instant and you can do so much more with it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're just playing with pixels.
Yep.
Whereas you had film, you had to scan it in, you had to cut it up and things like that and blend it and then expose it onto a piece of paper.
And there was no delete and redo.
Oh, no. Once you'd cut that negative up, that was it. It was gone. you know, and things like that. But today, you know, what you can do with the programs that are available today are far, far better and far greater, you know, than, you know, you used to be able to do back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
But it's all a question of how you think about it. All the genres have been shot. There's nothing new there. It's, you've just got to find a new slant and a new take on it.
Yeah, definitely. So you still shoot film?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Just for personal projects or for commercial clients?
No, just for personal stuff.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, and, you know, I think one of my biggest thrills was to see my son's face at four, maybe five, I was developing. He wanted to know, because I was doing a course at the time, he wanted to know why he couldn't see the picture on the back of Dad's camera. And I thought, this is about time he needed to have a bit of indoctrination into the world of chemicals.
Yeah, right.
And so I did it simple. I did black and white. And we went out and shot it on a rolly cord, twin lens.
Right.
And so I've only got 12 shots.
Yeah.
So I put a roll of 36. I told him what we were doing and all that. We went out to the park, put it on a tripod. And I said, right, in a minute, I'm going to stand there, push that cord in when I say now. And I got in my cable release. He did exactly the same. We took the shots, came back, processed it in a tank in the laundry. And I thought, right, 3, 2, 1, opened up the lid. He goes, where's the pictures? Where are the pictures? And then, as I pulled them out, he's just seen these latent images and he's gone, wow.
Yeah.
He's gone quiet. He goes, so how do we get them on the TV? I go, oh, no. And then a few years later, I was working at TAFE, and I had permission to take them in, and I went into one of the biggest dark rooms in Sydney. And I had a class with me, and we were teaching them printing, and I got them to have a look at actually how a print was made, and their faces. They could just about see over the bath, but their faces were the picture. Because there was just 2 points in my career that I thought, thank God for that. That was great. I just wish I had a camera, but having a flash go off in a dark room, not a good idea.
No. So when you are shooting film for your own personal projects, what's your film stock of choice?
Oh, I'm a Fuji fan.
Are you?
I like color-wise.
Velvia?
I do like Velvia, which if you can get hold of it, Velvia 50 you can't get anymore.
Oh, really?
No, they made Velvia 50 for a long time.
Okay.
But yeah, Fuji, I've always liked that. But if I was doing black and whites, which I absolutely love, again, another film that you can't get readily available now is the old Kodak Tri-X.
Right.
That was a film that you could really abuse. And, when
As
I said
for pushing and pulling.
Pushing and pulling, yeah. It was one where you could buy it, you got an 800 ISO and you pushed it to 1600, 3200, and the contrast was fantastic.
Yeah, right.
That's why the newspapers used it, because you could really abuse the damn thing.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of stuff. So which was good, and that was the fun about film. You can, push it, pull it, use filters, do all kinds of stuff, and a lot of the techniques that you see in Photoshop and stuff like that, that's where it's all come from.
Yeah, right. Am I right though in thinking that if you decided to do a push or pull process on a roll of film, you had to use that process for the whole roll of the film, yeah?
Yeah, there was no way, not like a digital camera where you can change the ISO from one to the other. That was 36 shots, and if you wanted to push it to, say, from 800 to 1600, which is what, one stop, you'd have to push it all, the whole roll had to be shot at that. And when you took it into the lab, you had to say, this has been pushed one stop, can you process it accordingly?
Yep.
So it wasn't just, you didn't just take it at that one stop pushed, you had to have it processed accordingly. Yeah.
That's right.
Or then you could also, what they call, you could develop film in a C41 and put them in an E6 system and cross-process and that kind of, that was always fun.
Yep.
I did do
radical colour interpretations out of it.
Oh, and that kind of stuff. I mean, I used to do black and whites at home. I had to play with colour, but colour was a bit more precise, especially with the temperature of the liquids and that kind of stuff, where, black and white, you could do pretty much anything with it.
Excellent. All right. Well, moving on. Adam sent us a story about the Kronos high-speed camera, which was a crowdfunded thing that we spoke about three or four episodes back. This was the camera that was capable of shooting like 170,000 frames a second or something. It was ridiculously fast, but it was at quite a small resolution. What was interesting about that particular crowdfunding effort was that they reached their funding goal of $48,000 in 5 hours.
Wow, there's a lot of believers out there.
Absolutely. Either that or a lot of people who are really interested in high-speed photography.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm looking at it now. I mean, I'm looking at the frame rate, 1,957.
Was that what it was? I knew it was something
crazy.
That's
full resolution. That's full resolution. I think, holy crap. That's, but I think the fastest says, what does it say? It says high-speed, Kronos can shoot high-speed video with 1,900 frames per second at full resolution of 1280. to 1024 pixels.
Right, but they had a much smaller resolution that did an even higher frame rate, if I recall.
Yeah, the lower resolution takes it up to 21,600, a fast. Yeah, that's a lot.
So 5 hours to reach their funding goal, so that's pretty amazing.
Try getting a flash to go with that.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe constant light source. Wonder, I like the film at the bottom of it where they got the mower blowing up.
I haven't looked at that.
If you scroll down the page, there's an upturned bladed mower, lawn mower, and it looks like they've dropped something into it, and it's just shattered them.
Oh, okay. Nice. So, yeah. I'll have to check that out. The next one that Adam sent us was 111 portrait looks with different lights and modifiers. And this was from petapixel.com, essentially just a headshot of a girl, but 111 different looks.
I try and do something like that with my portraiture, with my portraiture students and all that at college, and it's amazing the results, but I don't think they can get 111.
And I bet it blows their mind to think that there are that many possibilities.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, she's got different facial expressions and all that, but yeah, the lighting's just changing a little bit with ratios, and it looks pretty much, just look by the screen grab, it just pretty much, the light looks the same. It's side lit, broad.
Yeah.
There's not too much difference. Yeah. It's just different facial expressions, really.
And obviously, distances and angles between light and subject.
Yeah, they have just different reflectors and all that, and then that's it. And then they take a further back, and you see the different types of shadows and that kind of stuff and effects, which, cool.
Yeah. The next one that Adam sent us was a photographer who 3D printed a lens. This whole 3D printing thing has just gone crazy. So this guy has created a cardboard prototype using glass. Now, it says an 1890s lens. I'm thinking that might be a typo and that it was actually a 1980s lens.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because I can't imagine you would go and butcher a 130-year-old lens for the sake of this project. I'd like to think that you would only butcher a 35-year-old lens.
Yeah, well, I've gone onto the website and you scroll down the page and he's got a Sony Alpha 7 with this lens on it. And it looks like you've made something from a piece of definitely cardboard and
toilet
paper.
That's what it looks like. Yeah.
But, wow.
So I'm hoping the lenses were pilfered from a 1980s lens, not an 1890s lens. The interesting thing about these images is there's quite serious aberration around the edges, like it's only sharp in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, the classic ones, that the island, it's lovely bokeh around the edge of it. I mean, I like it, but and then you've got some nice portraits.
It's fine if you want that look for every image.
Yeah.
Too bad if you want to shoot landscapes and you want some clarity all the way out to the edges.
Yeah, that's it. It's very much going on the old Holgers.
Yes.
And that kind of, fun lenses, which are great fun to use, but don't think I could see, I could see an application of using it commercially, but not every day.
No.
Certainly domestic portraiture and that
makes,
kind of stuff.
Makes a good thing for some portraiture and certainly would be a good talking point.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, they look reasonably sharp, but then again, we are only looking on a screen and they're not that big, so.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, what's the next one? Billion Getty Images lawsuit.
Yeah, so I did say when we covered this story 4 or 5 months ago, I did say, keep us in the loop if you hear any more about this story. And of course, it, wasn't likely to escape our attention because the verdict was handed down this week that the court ruled in favor of Getty Images.
What?
Essentially, yeah, I know. And as they say in the story, if you're bamboozled by this outcome, you're not the only one. The paragraph that I found interesting was, the judge hasn't released any written explanation of his ruling, but it seems the court accepted Getty's argument. Public domain works are regularly commercialized, and the original author holds no power to stop this. As for the now infamous collections letter, that is the letter that Getty sent to Carol Highsmith, seeking payment for the use of her own images. Getty painted it as an honest mistake that they addressed as soon as they were notified of the issue by Carol Highsmith. So,
yeah, right.
Yes, anyway. Yeah.
Oh, that's a hornet's nest there, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Totally.
I think a lot of people
were hoping that Getty were going to get slapped and slapped hard for this, but certainly doesn't appear that that's how it's
I hear so many stories about, you know Getty and other people like that. You know, they just take the images and, you know, you don't credit the photographer. If you've got your metadata, yeah, some of it can be stripped out. But I've heard of programs on there that can actually watermark the pixel of the image. And it's like, you remember the tracker devices that you can get in the car where you spray the car bonnet with these little micro discs and you can never get rid of them. It's a bit like that with each pixel.
Right.
And it's got a watermark. And it's not visible, but it's this software can read this pixel. So you can take a small cutting of a certain section of that image and somebody can use it and you can still find it.
Wow.
I know. I thought that, but you know, I think the software is a little bit on the pricey side. But how anal and how far do you go to protect your work?
Yeah,
that's the question.
Yeah,
you know.
Funny that you should bring up the topic of stripping metadata, because that sort of leads us to the next story, which was submitted by Steve Peters.
Yeah,
and this was about a German photographer who sued Facebook because, when he uploaded his images to Facebook in Germany, Facebook has an algorithm, I guess, as it's uploading the images, it stripped out the IPTC metadata.
Oh,
now
that's not nice.
I'm guessing, I haven't looked this up, and you could probably confirm this for me, is that the copyright owner's information? Is that what that is?
Yep, and that's the kind of stuff that you put in when you do your metadata in, when you're putting in Lightroom and Photoshop and all that, and, you know, your home address, your phone number, your email, your copyright rules,
right,
and all that kind of stuff. And if you've got a model release for it and your permission, all that gets stripped out. That's
not
good. So
apparently what happened was that he, you know, started legal action back in February of this year, and the courts ruled that Facebook had 6 months to do something about it. The 6 months passed, they hadn't done anything about it, and so he then took it a step further and successfully sued Facebook in Germany. Now, this is the interesting, or the important part, is that this is only affecting the German market at this point in time, although the story on Petapixel does suggest that this could create a precedent for photographers worldwide.
I would have thought it would do, because it's like any rule of law, they'll always refer to somebody that's done it beforehand, even if it's in Germany. So I think good on him.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I put stuff up on Facebook and Instagram, but I don't put stuff that I don't want. You know, you don't put stuff up there that you don't want to lose.
Yeah.
You know, up, you know, the kind of stuff that I put up there is, you know, oh, I'm on this set today, or I'm doing that today, and, you know, just background shots and that kind of stuff, and all tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
You know, I can never take Facebook serious.
No. Yeah. All right. Well, mate, it's been great having you on this episode.
My pleasure. Anytime. Anytime. I'd love to come back if you want me to.
Yeah, for sure.
You know.
So I've got a couple of things still to cover but I'll let you go.
Sure, I don't mind hanging around.
Sorry?
I don't mind hanging around.
Oh, well, I've got a couple of audio clips to play and you're not going to hear them, unfortunately. So we tried to sort this out before we started recording and I couldn't get the audio routed in such a fashion that I could play it off my computer and have Darren hear it through Skype. So,
the world of Skype.
Yeah. you'd think, being an audio engineer, I'd be able to work this stuff out, but
no comment.
Yeah, exactly. Well, mate, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
We'll,
anytime, mate.
We'll chat with you soon.
Okay, then, yeah, by all means. Anyway, see you guys. Take care. Happy Christmas, by the way.
Yeah, same to you, mate.
Okay.
And we'll talk to you soon.
One. Bye. See you soon. Bye.
All right, so the last couple of things, obviously David Marlin's book review, which I'll get to in just a second, but Rob Coates decided, rather than sending me a boring old email, he'd send me an audio commentary relating to episode 358. What do you got to say for yourself, Rob?
G'day, Bruce. I just listened to episode 358 and very much enjoyed your conversation with Craig Wetchen. He sounds like a very personable character, and I love his philosophy on photography, namely have fun and play. A couple of thoughts on the episode. I agree with you that the supermoon thing was thoroughly overhyped. The moon's orbit is elliptical, which means that it isn't a perfect circle, but once a month it's relatively close to Earth, 362,000 kilometres, and 2 weeks later it's relatively far from the Earth, about 405,000 kilometres. This closest and farthest distance is very a tiny bit, but not much. So every month the moon is at its closest to Earth, and every now and then that coincides with what we call a full moon, when the sun, the Earth and the moon line up. There hadn't been the hype on social media prior to this month's supermoon, I'd put money on the fact that no one would have noticed. Craig's comment that the tree in his photo gave the moon a point of reference is a good one. The photo of the moon high in the sky is, well, boring. Look on Flickr or similar websites. In all of the shots of the moon that are not boring, the moon is either rising or setting, and there's some sort of earthly foreground, trees, clouds, cityscape, seascape, etc., that give the shot of the moon some sort of scale. On the subject of white balance, I have a Nikon D7000. I mentioned that before. And I have it on auto white balance all the time. I never alter it. That seems to handle white balance pretty well. And for the odd shot that is too cold or too warm, because I shoot in RAW, it's not a problem to adjust that. If there is a conflict of white balance within a shot, say some daylight and also an artificial light, Lightroom's brush tool makes it easy to alter the white balance in just part of the image. One final observation. When Craig said that if your outlook is, I don't enjoy photographing landscapes but I enjoy photographing people, well then pretend the landscapes are people. I don't know about you, but Glyn sprang to mind. Perhaps you might play in Craig's comment on that when he gets back. Meantime, thanks for the show. As always, the seven of us always enjoy it.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah, the whole supermoon thing was completely overblown in my opinion. I agree with you. I very much doubt whether, had it not been so widely publicised, whether or not people would have really noticed a difference. But, I mean, Craig seemed to think last week that, yes, there was a noticeable difference, but maybe that's because you're looking for it. I don't know. Anyway. All right, so let's wrap it up with David Marlin's book review, The Film Photography Handbook. Off you go, David.
Thanks, Bruce. Are you feeling retro, feeling like it was better in the good old days? Or maybe you've inherited a film camera and want to give it a go? Or you're just curious about film? Whatever your motivation, there seems to be a resurgence of interest in using film, for all its limitations and inconveniences. Chris Marquardt and Monica Andre, podcasters and Munich-based photographers, have written the Film Photography Handbook. It's subtitled Rediscovering Photography in 35mm medium and large range format. It's a very approachable book for those wanting to get into or even re-enter the world of film photography. This hardback, produced by Rocky Nook, asks, why film photography? Analog or digital, how do they compare? It then goes into cameras and film formats, 35, medium, and large format. Also produces some tips on buying a camera, because most film cameras now, of course, are secondhand. What to look for. There's information about exposure, because you no longer have a digital display. And a fair bit about film, black and white film, colour film, instant film. Then it gets into processing. Talks about industrial laboratories, professional laboratories, and then processing film yourself in black and white and in colour. And has a whole lot of information and different processes you can use with good illustrations and pictures. Then it gets into post-processing. There's traditional post-processing, then there's the hybrid analog digital method, where you scan your films in and then work at it from there. A bit about digital printing, some of the historical processes, and then gets onto how to present your photo. That's pretty general for most photos. A bit about storage and archiving, particularly the considerations around storing negatives and prints. And a bit of a scary subheading there is a tidy house, a tidy mind. And then having fun with planned accidents. Different cameras, whether it be a box camera, a Holger or a pinhole. Fun with expired film, what you can do, how you can experiment it. Look, there's a lot of clear pictures and diagrams in the book and it's easy to follow. If there's a gap, it's in the post-processing. There's almost nothing about traditional enlarging and printing. The preference here is a hybrid process, scanning your negatives so that enables you to use software like Lightroom and print it on a digital printer. The Film Photography Handbook is a hardback and it's published by Rocky Nook. Booko has the price ranging from $33.32 to $69.99 in dollars Australian shipped. I went to Rocky Nook, who they offer the book as hardback for $39.95 US plus postage. They offer the ebook version of it as $31.95. which seems a bit expensive to me. It also seems a bit odd that a digital edition of a book on film, it might seem a bit incongruous, I think. But the package of both is $49.95, again, US, plus a bit of postage. Now, I know that Rocky Nook and Craft and Visions and others are very heavy marketers, and they send out regular newsletters. They're pretty keen, and they have discounts, particularly if you pre-order books or if you're subscribing, that they have weekly discounts. So books like this could be obtained a bit cheaper. So keep an eye out for that. Cheers.
Awesome. Thank you, David. All right, and that brings it to the end of another episode. And we've got another guest lined up for next week. Won't tell you who that is yet. And the week after that, I think Lynn will be back from Myanmar. And for those who follow him on Facebook, you've probably seen some of the images that he's posting. And got to say, I did really, really like the image of the three fishermen sitting on their little dugout canoe type thingamajiggies on the lake. Yeah, nice image, Glenn. All right, I will speak to you again next week. Until then, take care.
ShutterZinkPodcast.com.
Another AudioTier.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZinkPodcast.com.